Welcome to today's Scaling with People podcast. I have Douglas Skrull with me, and he's going to talk to us about tech enablement. Douglas, or AKA Skrull, tell us a little bit about yourself and your past.
Sure. So I'm sitting here in England. I'm English, although I don't sound like it. I talk a little funny. And I'm sitting in my 600-year-old house near the Channel Tunnel. And I've been here in England working as some kind of senior technical leader, CTO, VP of engineering, all those kinds of roles for something like 25 years. I've lost count now. And what happened to me was that all the way through, as I learned and I became better at being a leader, because I was terrible when I started, I can tell you for sure. And I got better and better, and I kept getting fired. And I kept getting fired in this really nice way, where the founder of the startup, because there was a series of startups I was in, would say, Skrull, you built this amazing team and they're working really well together now. And we have a roadmap they're completing and executing. And there's a good leader you've trained up and there's not much for you to do. And gosh, you're kind of expensive. So could you please go be wonderful somewhere else? And it was this very nice way to get fired. But the third or fourth time I noticed the pattern. And it was also getting shorter, so it was taking less and less time to get fired. And so I said, maybe I should just plan for this. Maybe I'm just the sort of person who gets things sorted out and gets out of the way. And that sounds like a consultant. So that's what I've done now. So I've become the guy you go to make your tech team insanely profitable. And my expertise on that has taken me to, I think, every continent now except Antarctica. I'm looking forward to working with penguins, but I haven't done that yet. And pretty much every industry. So I get to work in healthcare and finance and e-commerce and satellites and you name it. I've wound up playing with it at some point. And the result of that is I've got all kinds of ideas on how to make tech people much easier to work with as your company scales and to enable the company to make much huger revenues. And the secret to all of that is better conversations.
Oh, yeah. Communication, right?
Well, and not just communication, but the specific action of having a conversation like this, because often when people talk about communication, they're talking about things like an all hands or an email to the whole company or communicating to investors. And those are all great things. We should get better at those. But I'm talking about going to someone in the tech team, say, and explaining why the bug that they created could have caused someone to cut off part of their bodies. This happens in my biochem companies where they have medical devices that test people. And, you know, your bug could have had this effect and that has this effect on our company. And this is what we need to do about it because we want you to get better. Now, that's a difficult conversation, you can imagine.
Yep.
And having those difficult conversations helps make your tech team improve much faster than you'd imagine, but they're also difficult. So I wrote a whole book on how to do that better. And I'm spreading the word as fast as I can about communication, specifically conversations, to help improve your technology.
I think that's really important. And what's your book called?
My book is called Agile Conversations. And, you know, if listeners want a copy, don't tell my publisher I said this, but I'll send you one. So yeah, get in touch with me at douglasskrull.com. I'm not here to sell books. I'm interested in getting the information out. So
I love
get
that.
In touch with me. I'll send you a copy.
Well, that's a great offer. Thank you so much, Skrull. I'm going to call you by your nickname, Skrull. I love it. That's so much fun.
That's what everyone calls me. There's lots of Douglases and not many squirrels. So,
so true.
Keeps track of me better.
So our listeners are all about startups. They're founders and CEOs listening in. And so what?
My favorite people.
Mine too. What are some of the things that you would recommend a founder or startup probably in, you know, the early stages, right? Pre-seed, probably less than 50 people, maybe in the 100, but most likely less than 50 people. What do you recommend that they start to consider in regards to implementing and taking care of on their technology front to support their growth?
Yeah. So one of the most important things to do is to make sure that your technology doesn't run away with itself. And what happens to all us engineers, and I'm a coder at heart, I love technology, I love cool stuff. And the problem is that we will tell you with absolutely straight face, very earnestly, because we believe it, that the cool, nifty technology and the wonderful things that we have planned are exactly what customers need. And we're almost always wrong. So don't believe us. Go and
Yep.
verify with actual customers. And the thing is, you wouldn't believe a salesperson, at least I hope you would never believe a salesperson about how likely a sale is to close. And you wouldn't believe a marketing person about where you're going to place on Google. You know to apply a grain of salt with those things, typically, or a customer service about how many calls there'll be and so on. You know they can't predict the future in that way. You know that that what you want is data from them that validates what they're telling you, because everyone has a sort of bias in favor of their discipline. The problem is us engineers, we have all these beautiful, complicated obfuscations that we use to make it sound like we know special magic language, and we don't. We don't know anything more about how customers, what customers need than you do. And so stop believing us when we tell you that we know the answer. Believe customers when they say, this is what I need, and believe us when we show you working software.
Yeah, that I feel like that almost ties into that conversation piece that you were talking about a minute ago
Of course it
of like,
does.
how do you make sure you're having the right conversation with your customers? And even the customers might not know exactly what they mean. So asking those deep dive questions to get to root causes to really be able to be impactful to those customers and then go out and build it.
And even better, build something, but build it very, very cheaply and have the conversation about the thing. Because the problem is that customers typically have a very clear idea of what they want and no idea what they need and no idea
Yeah.
what they'll think of what they want when they actually have it. So if you're building, say, an e-commerce website and you want to sell shoes, then there are standard things off the web that you can just get and run, and you don't need any of us techies at all. And I'd suggest you do as much as you can with off-the-shelf technology, with minimal code and investment in us expensive engineers, and get as much as you can in front of actual customers to find out how it works. And one of the horrible dangers that bites people in the behind is that they get started on something that looks exciting. They think they know. They think they're sure how it's going to work, and they believe the kind. They kind of swallow the technical Kool-Aid, and they come along to me and they say, "Squirrel, how can we take this to market?" And I say, "How about if we stop, and we go figure out what we actually need first?"
Yeah, I love that. That's so important. And so if a founder or CEO is already kind of like trains left the station there, anything in regards to like recommendations on how they can figure out, ooh, I need to slow this down or pull it back or make it more simple or I don't know, just figure out that they've already gotten too far and they need to pull
Ah,
it back.
well, here's something that will tell you for sure whether you're sort of leaving the station, whether you're way down the track on the wrong course, and that is what your cycle time is. Now, if you ask your engineers about cycle time, they'll tell you something they can get out of a system that's kind of a mechanical thing. Don't use that. Don't believe the engineers about that either, because they're the tools that will tell them some number that represents the cycle time. But the cycle time is a very simple idea. It just means the time between when you say, I'm really going to work on something. This is a thing I'm going to add to the software that I have. Because I'm working with you saying, you know, we already have some software. And the time when a customer sees it. And the customer may not have something that fully works, or that they may hate it. That would be good. It's fantastic if they say this is terrible, because then you're getting feedback, and you want that cycle time to be as short as humanly possible. I teach people typically to make it one day.
Oh,
So
wow,
if
that
your
is really
cycle,
short.
exactly, and the point is that then you can get the feedback incredibly quickly, and you can correct all your mistakes. So making mistakes is totally fine. But what, tends to happen the other direction is folks say, well, I really want to be predictable. I want to know exactly what's going to happen. I want to know months in advance so I can plan my marketing. And what I'll just do is I'll make some very detailed roadmap that shows everything we're going to do. We'll get very detailed requirements. I hate that term. And we'll specify what the engineers will do. And then we hope it'll all happen. And surprisingly, it never happens. And when it does happen, it's not what they want. And that tends to be quite a messy situation. That's when people call me in and I can help them with it. But much better not to get into it in the first place by making sure your cycle time is really short. And if you're not sure how to do that, then ask your engineers. They actually know, but they often don't believe you that that's something that you want to do. So there's lots you can do to improve that cycle time and make it faster. But you got to convince your engineers you really want to make mistakes quickly.
That is so interesting. I've been in tech my entire career, and we're going on to two digits, not to age myself, right? That is the first time I've heard that. One day. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So I call it elephant carpaccio. Like... It's a name somebody else came up with, but I developed it further. And the idea is you take your big elephant, your big thing that you want to get done, and you slice it into really thin pieces. Do you know what carpaccio is? It's a type of food.
No,
it's Italian meat. I'm a vegetarian, so it's a terrible analogy for me. But it's Italian meat that's so thin you can see through it. So I could hold it up here and I could wave at you and say hi, Guinevere.
Okay.
And the point is, you're taking your big project, a big, huge thing that you want to build, and you make it into tiny, tiny, tiny pieces. And the pieces are so small that you get tremendous feedback very quickly on them. But they're very, very small. For example, it might be that you build a button that says, I had a client who wanted something they could pick colors with. You know, that thing that has kind of a circle and it has the different colors. And I'm terrible with colors, but, you know, it has a circle and you can pick things. They wanted to do that. So they put up a button that said color picker. But when you click the button, nothing happened. That was how small it was. And they could definitely do that in a day. And then customers phoned up and they said, hey, the color picker doesn't work. And they said, great. What did you want to change the color of? What was the color picker for? How does it work for you? So they got a lot of information from their customers about the color picker. And then they moved on to the next slice and the next slice and the next slice. And over a succession of days, they had a color picker. But they built it exactly the way the customer wanted. If they'd just gone away and built whatever they felt like, they would have built it in the wrong place or the button in the wrong screen, changing the color of the wrong thing. They had all that feedback all the way along. Now you have to do some work to do that. It's not a trivial activity, but if you have the right conversation with your engineers about how to do that, and you are credible in saying you really want to make mistakes, have customers phone up and say this doesn't work, get that kind of feedback quickly, you can move incredibly fast.
Wow. Yeah. My mind's blown right now, because again,
I've used engineers for
a long time, and I have never heard this concept. So when a CEO or founder is considering evaluating improvements or change, your recommendation is to do it in these bite-sized ways.
Absolutely. And I will say this, that there are certain industries in which one day is unrealistic, and biotech is one of them. I talked about, cutting people's parts of their bodies off as a result of a test. Let's not mess that up after a day. Yes, let's not give them a button that doesn't work. But I can do that in 2 weeks. So I have biotech clients who make changes to things that are close to medical devices, not quite, but very close, the same kind of regulations, and they make tiny, tiny changes in safe environments. They're not rolling it out to everyone, but they get that kind of feedback that rapidly. And 2 weeks is a tiny, tiny slice in the world of biotech, where it takes years to roll out new things. So if you can get that kind of radical difference that shows to your customers that you care, that you're making improvements, that you're rapidly changing, they'll forgive you a ton of things. They'll forgive you all kinds of mistakes, so long as you can rapidly improve way faster than the competition. It makes a huge, huge difference to your pace of growth.
So, customers, clients are different in different industries. Generally speaking, you're going to start this process out. How do you engage with your customers or clients to start getting that feedback in a timely fashion, so that that color, in the example of the color button, in 2 weeks time, it is what it should be. And it's not 2 weeks later, we're still waiting for one customer to tell us that it's broken.
So this, and you said it's different by industry. It absolutely is, especially how many customers you have. So I have a client I was just working with today, and they have three or four customers at the moment. They want to have 10 or 20. So this is selling to businesses, very big, very slow moving businesses, who tend to hand them big requirements documents and say, here, build this stuff. So what I'm helping them to do is move away from that and say, hey, customer, I'll get to that. That's my elephant. How about if I do page 1.5 first? Can I just do this little bit of what you want? The challenge there is that you have to educate the customer about how that's valuable to them, and they may not be happy with it. You may also have to fire some customers who are not willing to consider working with you that way. If you're in retail, so you have thousands of customers or hundreds of thousands, you have much greater volumes, you can do things like the color picker with the button, and some percentage of people will come back to you, and you can get feedback that way. If you have a small number, you may have to prepare them individually and say, you're going to hate what I bring you first. But if you talk to any good designer, any good architect, any good artist, they will tell you as they're working through their process to build their creative output, that if they're building it to spec for you, they're going to bring you something terrible first. And they will tell you that because nobody can get it right the first time. And if they know that if they go away and they build a perfect blueprint and they build a scale model and they have the, you know, your beautiful building all ready and they bring it to you, they're going to get it wrong for sure. And they're going to have to knock that down. Much better to show you a quick sketch so that you can tell them what's wrong with it. And this is what you're doing with your customers in these cases. So you have to educate them, whether there are many or few, so that they're ready for this. And you may have to whittle some, you may have to weed out some who aren't willing to do that. But that's usually worth doing because those are not the customers you want anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that does make sense. So switching gears a little bit, you said earlier, you know, you build your tech teams to the point where they're totally thriving and, you know, don't need to be spending an expensive salary of you got to go. Thank you so much. So let's talk about teams and people, right? So when you have someone who's doing, you know, you're working with the founders or even leaders of technology, and they have someone that is just doing an inept job. You know, a lot of times, stereotypically speaking, engineers can be a little less empathetic than other leaders. So what do you tell them?
Not only stereotypically, you can't be empathetic with a computer. Empathy with a computer does not help you. So we're pretty carefully trained not to involve our emotions, which is terrible when we then have to deal with all you crazy humans out there.
So what recommendations or what have you been advising your customers, clients on in regards to how to manage an employee that is inept at their job?
Well, so the first thing you can do is hire me and I'll coach them. And you don't have to do that. There's lots that you can do yourself. The most important thing is to make sure that the expectations are clear. And what often happens exactly at this scaling moment that I know a lot of your clients are at or aspiring to, or they're just going through it, is that you have these kind of early hackers, the kind of folks who are really focused on code, who can get anything done, they can perform magic with a computer, and they're wonderful at that, and you don't need them to be very good managers, because you can just hand them something and say, build this, and they do it. And then suddenly they have to deal with all these annoying humans, and they have to hire a bunch more engineers, and they have to start hiring people like designers, like product managers and folks like that. And you suddenly discover that the person who was absolutely brilliant at producing the early version sucks at building the team that will then produce more. And that person is not good at delegating. Now, the good news is that I teach loads of people to do this. And that's what my book's all about. It's got exercises and tools that use development and software analogies to help engineers understand how to talk to people outside the tech team, tools that people outside the tech team can use to talk to people inside the tech team. There's a lot of methods that you can use to do this better. But they're not intuitive, and people almost certainly won't pick them up on their own, or rather they will, but it'll take them 20 years. Sure. And you usually don't have 20 years. So my recommendation is don't wait 20 years for the person to figure it out. Coach them, help them improve their conversations, help them improve their management skills with the help of a coach like me, or with the help of techniques like in my book and other things like that. But don't give them very long, because you want to set them a fairly steep hill to climb and say, well, you're down here, you need to be up here. And if they don't get there, you need to move on and get someone who has done it before, who has the skill. And if you wait too long, hiring that person is going to take you many months already, and you may not have that much runway, especially with the kind of funding market that we have today. You don't have as much time and energy to play with, and your competitors may overtake you by the time you're able to get the right technical leader in place. So push hard, get that engineer, get that leader to move and to improve. And many of them do, especially with the right kind of help. And if that doesn't work, find somebody, but don't rest on your laurels. Don't let the grass grow.
I think that is such a huge, like, I hope all the founders hear that, because that is one of the things that I struggle with when I come in and support founders, is that they have this amazing person or a couple people that are just amazing. This company was built on their back, sweat, tears, blood, everything, right? This
and
company
you feel
wouldn't
obligated
exist
to.
Without them.
You're
you
like,
feel obligated.
Oh, you know, you did such a great job for me. You may have to fire them. That may be the kindest thing to do for them.
Not everyone is able to scale up as the company scales. And I find that this happens around Series C, maybe D timeframe. And I always kind of say, in a life cycle of a company, Series C is like graduating high school and going to college. And not everyone goes to college, right? And that's okay. We need the people that don't go to college. We need the plumbers and the car repairmen and the electricians, right? But for your business, you need the people that are going to be able to take your company to the next level. And, you know, if there's an opportunity for you to keep that person there, but take them out of a manager role and let them become IC, maybe a principal, a team lead that has experience, right?
You bring a VP of engineering next to them. And then that person really runs the team, and the CTO becomes the research director, becomes the person who has new ideas. And that's often a smooth off ramp to get out of the company as well. Which is not always a bad thing.
Yeah, so true. So true. Okay, so I got to ask, a lot of things I see in startups is that they'll hire someone who's very corporate mindset, hasn't been in a startup or hasn't really kind of changed their mind. How do you handle dealing with tech people or even other people within the leadership that are so corporate mindset that they are not recognizing they're in a startup and need to go fast?
Yep. That's where you need very clear accountability and setting the right objectives for them. And this is often new to founders, because the founder will say, well, I haven't actually led this kind of person before. And the person can be very impressive. And this happens outside tech, too. This happens with salespeople and heads of finance and other folks who come in with this tremendous pedigree. And they say, great. So where is my 70-person finance team that can do all my invoicing for me? And you say, well, there's your desk. There's nobody here. And they really can't function in that environment. You get this with people who have an IT background rather than a software background as well. So you hire someone who has run the IT function at a significant size company, and everything was outsourced. You know, the engineers were all far away. They were using tools that were already developed and finished and in good shape. And so it was all maintenance. And suddenly you're trying to innovate and build something completely new, and they're deer in the headlights. They don't know how to operate. So the first thing to do is don't hire those people if you can possibly avoid it, and identify them through the hiring process. And I help people with that hiring process often, and I'm filtering out those sorts of people. I'm looking, you know, a very positive sign is someone who has started a startup before. Another positive sign is someone who has worked in multiple sizes of business. It's great if you've been at Meta or Facebook or whatever they're called this week, but it's also you should be at something that no one's heard of and probably failed, and that's okay. So those are signals you can use in the hiring process. If you've got someone like that, it's not irreparable. I've seen those folks function well, especially if they're motivated. They say, I hate the corporate environment. It's so frustrating, so stifling to have to get seven levels of approval.
Yeah.
And you say, great, now you're giving yourself approval, but here are the outcomes I'm looking for. And you often, time is one of the best ones to push them on. In the tech world, it would be the cycle time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were suitably shocked by releasing new software every day. You want that kind of shock from whatever it is that they might be doing. Oh, you know, I want to break into a new country every month in sales. And the salesperson says, great, but I'm the only salesperson. So, yeah, well, you know, get your frequent flyer program in place, because you're going to be going to a new country every month to break in. And if you can get that kind of shocked look from them and then they act, you're in good shape. Then you're having the difficult conversation, you're setting the challenging outcome, and they're rising to it. If they don't rise to it, you need to back to the drawing board, and you need somebody who can, and ideally someone who's done it before.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, the speed is the game here, you know, not just kind of going, she or he will step up in the next week. It's like, if they're not doing it now, they're probably not going to do it next week. get on them and get on to finding someone that will do it for you. Well, Squirrel, this has been so much fun. I just realized how much time we've already spent together. I'd love to close it out with just asking what other tidbits or tips that you could share with the listeners today.
Well, I'll give you one of my favorites, because we've talked a bit about setting objectives and being accountable. And there's a tool that's in one of the later chapters. I think it's the last chapter of Agile Conversations, which is, and I got it from someone else. So I get a lot of my material from other people, and then I adapt it to our situation in startups and tech. And this is a tool from a book called Art of Action by a guy called Stephen Bungay, and it's called Briefing and Back Briefing. And the really simple version of that, and you can go read about it and learn more about it. But the simple version is you ask someone to perform an action. You give them a clear set of guidelines about what the goal is, what the constraints are, what they can't do, and what they're free to do. And then you give them a very, very short time to come up with what they're going to do, not enough to have done anything. And you have them come back and brief you on how they're going to do it. So you can give them lots of feedback and tell them constraints that you might not have thought of. So that process is one I teach to founders and CTOs and folks like that all the time, because it gives a very nice, very simple framework for delegating something to someone, making sure that you know that you're going to keep on top of them to make sure it happens the way you want. And we've just talked about several ways, several failure modes, right? So you know that when those failure modes happen, but you can get it out of your brain, because my back briefing is tomorrow at 3, and I don't have to think about this problem until then. When so-and-so is going to come back to me with a result. So that's one of my favorite techniques for setting these expectations in a way that's simple and easily manageable.
And what I also like about it is you take it the next step further. It goes back to doing, one release really quickly, getting the feedback from the customer. It's the same thing, right?
It's all the same principle.
Back, it gives you the back briefing. Okay, well, you didn't quite hear me, or I didn't quite communicate, or I forgot to tell you this, or you went a different direction than I did. Let's reset. Or yeah, this looks great. Add XYZ and go, right? You get that blessing. And before the person has spent all this time doing something that, gosh, that wasn't really what I meant for you to go and do.
Yep.
I love that. That is a great tip. Well, I hope everyone implements that right away, because that is a great tip. Well, thanks, Squirrel, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. And for all the listeners out there, have a wonderful day.
Absolutely. And I'll just mention at the end here that if you want to get in touch with me and you want a free copy of the book, like I said, look me up at douglassquirrel.com. Thanks so much for having me on, Gwendolyn.
Thanks, Squirrel. All right. Bye-bye.